All right, Psalm 27. This is a psalm about fears and anxieties, which is really helpful because we all know that fear and anxiety are things that can misshape our lives. And we don't want to be ruled and dominated by those things. In the 90s, there was this brand. I think it was more than just t-shirts. I think it was brand. It was like the No Fear brand, which sounds really cool, you know, because, you know, we want to be fearless, or we think that we do. We want to be that we think to have no fear means you're really brave and cool. But I knew something different because I had a cousin that was born without the ability to feel fear. And so I got to see what that's like when someone lives without that important emotion. And all the emotions that God has given us are really important, and fear is one of them. So my cousin, we all have these impulses to do things, but then there's all this restraining voice of fear that says, hey, don't do that. So anything that you can imagine that a little boy would feel curious about, and you would hope that the voice of fear would restrain them, he didn't have that. So his family had to really worry about him sticking his hand in the garbage disposal. Oh, it's let's turn it on and see what it feels like to put your hand down there. Or stick your hand in a lawnmower. Or touch this thing, or touch this thing. Or just anything that somebody would be curious about that could be harmful, he didn't have that cautioning voice of fear. Fear is really important. And so I saw that in his life. So, but the problem for all of us is that we don't want to be dominated by fear. We don't want fear and anxiety controlling our lives. But we also want the gift part of it. We want the part that says, hey, don't go down that way because there's tigers down there. Don't stick your hand in the garbage disposal. Don't date that girl. Don't talk to that person. Don't take that job. Those people don't treat each other right. Don't do these things. Come on in. Sowers! You're forgiven. Place of grace. Glad you're here. Hello, hello. So we're talking about fear in Psalm 27. Michael's a little upset because we skipped from 1 to 2 and went all the way to 3. Dusty's been upset about that a little bit, but we're okay. And I just talked about very briefly that I have a cousin that was born without the ability to feel fear. And we think that that would be a gift to not feel fear. But I got to see in his life that having a complete removal of fear in your life is actually a real big problem. It is a real challenge to your survival to not have fear. He always, anything that he was curious about, there was nothing that would keep him from like jumping off of something high that would kill you or break you, or sticking his hand into things like garbage disposals and things like that. He was like, hey, I'm curious what this would feel like. Ah! Fear is a really important thing, but we also don't want it to dominate our lives. So we are skipping a few of the Psalms, Michael, but I'm glad that you really care about them because they're so important. And the first two chapters were about what the Psalms is all about, and it is an incredible treasure trove to our life, especially when you know the background and you read the introductory chapters, chapter 1 and chapter 2, because what it's telling us is that it is a guide to how to be the ashrei in life, how to be blessed, how to be happy regardless of what your circumstances are. What an incredible gift. And it's a book of 150 songs and poems and prayers that were put together by people that their life had fallen apart. And so they weren't living good circumstances. And they said, here's the guide to ashreya, to the blessed life. Not blessed based on circumstances, but blessed in spite of and no matter what your circumstances are, because you have the favor of God on you.
One of the chapters in time order by story.
Hey, Michael, stop talking, please. So when we have a well-being and a calm and a peace and a strength in our life, that it's it's based on circumstances and only circumstances, that makes us weak and it makes us anxious and it makes us vulnerable. Why? Because that stuff can be taken away, right? Like if even if you get the thing that you think is going to make you feel okay, then we also know that we can lose it. And maybe and also maybe this isn't enough because we never get the thing that a circumstantial sense of security or strength or happiness or whatever and think, oh, whew, it's mine forever, right? And this is completely enough and it's mine forever. So what a gift this is that we have the guide of the Psalms teaching us how to be a Shreya no matter what we're going through. And the basic teachings in the intro is this, that we approach this book and we read this book with these things in mind. That number one, we live a God-facing life. Number two, we meditate on, delight in, and hope in God and His teachings. And number three, we live in hope and obedience to God's Messiah. And the rest of the Psalms are God-facing prayers, poems, and songs on how to live out those three lessons. Live a God-facing life, meditate on and delight in God and His Scripture and His teachings, and live in hope and obedience to God's Messiah. So Psalm 27 that we're skipping to is teaching us how to live those things out in relationship to fear. And we have the perfect guide in this in King David. We couldn't ask for a better guide on how to navigate fear in life than from him. So in our society today, we have more diagnoses of clinical levels of anxiety than any group of people to have ever walked the face of the earth. And at the same time, we have more money, we have more comfort, we have more security than anybody that has ever lived. So how can this be? Why are we so anxious? What's going on with us? We all want to be people who are strong and calm, clear-headed, confident and joyful in the midst of a crisis, right? But as a society and as a group of people, we're falling apart over so much less than the things that our ancestors built with. Hey, the harvest didn't go very well this winter. I think we're going to starve. Not all of us are going to make it. Hey, the people that with the pitchforks and the pointy things, they're coming over the hill to get us. It's not going to be good. We worry about phone calls and conversations and emails. So what can we do about that? We want to live our life where we are courageous and at peace. So how do we live with fear in an uncertain world? And so there's hardly any better guide for us than that I could think of in all of history than King David. There's people that are as good of him, but they didn't write the things down that he did. See, David lived his entire life being under threat. When he was a little boy, his parents sent him out to go and guard the sheep from wolves and lions and bears at an age where when we wouldn't trust most kids to just do anything unsupervised. Here's King David, the youngest of his family, going out and guarding these things from death. And he had to fend for himself. And then one day, he finds himself heading to the army of Saul, and he gets involved in a fight with King David, and he gets involved from there on out in political intrigue and armies and wars and fighting. And for the rest of his life, he is not safe, not for a single moment. He is always under threat of being killed. His family is always under threat of being killed, always, always, from enemies and from friends, from being betrayed. And yet he is telling us in Psalm 27 that he has found the secret to be content and to be at peace and to be confident, even when the worst things imaginable are staring him in the face moment after moment, day after day, that death and terror and torment are breathing on his neck and they're never going to stop. And what's even more than that, even more validating than that, is that people, the people that I was talking about, mentioned earlier, that wrote this, or didn't write it, that compiled the Psalms, they were people that they had just seen their whole world fall apart. They are living a post-apocalyptic existence and reality. Their world ended in blood and fire, and they suffered every terrible thing that a human being can suffer. And then they were captive, made captives by their enemies. And they read what David said about having peace in the midst of terrifying circumstances. And they believed that it held the answer to life. The answer for how they could become a strong and calm and clear and confident and joyful people no matter what it was that they faced. This is the answer. Tested out through King David's life, validated through people that were living in a post-apocalyptic, world-ending situation, knew what terror and trauma was all about. David found the answer. And if he found the answer, and if the people that found his teachings and compiled them and passed them on to us found the answer, and validated that to get through their lives, then surely, absolutely, this will help us out when we're afraid to make a phone call, to have a conversation, to show up at work about what will happen if the bills don't get paid, if we lose our job, conversation with a doctor, whatever it is that makes us afraid. And it's fairly simple. David, all of his findings that he's sharing with us in Psalm 27 comes down to two things. And if we just do these two things, then we will be the people like he is: calm, courageous, clear, confident, unmovable in the midst of any circumstances. So the first one is that we need to accept that life is a battlefield. A battlefield is a place of where paranoia and hypervigilance are completely warranted. If you are not paranoid and hypervigilant on a battlefield, then you are out of touch with reality. It's a place where any degree of safety or security that you have is only temporary, and it's limited. A battlefield is the very opposite of home. Home is a place of safety and security and well-being, of healing and rest. It's a place where you go, hopefully, to be yourself instead of who the job or the role or anything else needs you to be. And the truth is that we long for home, but we live in a battlefield. We long for home, but we live in a battlefield. And that dynamic shapes your life, and it shapes my life. We long for home, but life is a battlefield. We think if we can just get this thing, then we'll feel at home. If we can just get this amount of money or accomplish this task, then we'll feel at home. If we can get this job, if we can get this situation, then we'll feel at home. If I can meet a girl, if a boy likes me, if I can get married, if I can have kids, if I can get a house, if I can defend against this concern, if I can get this out of my life, if I could move to a different town, if. But no matter how things change, the battlefield is still there, and the longing for home never goes away. Ask any wise person who already has what it is that you're ifing for, what you are ifing for. Ask any wise person what it is. I made that word up. I hope it's okay. Ask any wise person who already has what you are ifing for, and they will tell you that there are some things that are worth having in life, worth striving for, worth sacrificing for, worth aiming for. But the battle never goes away. And sometimes when you have the thing that you've been ifing for, the battle just gets more intense. So we long for home, but life is a battlefield. And we live in this tension. And because we do, different people react to that in different ways. And I'm not going to ask you to be self-reflective. I do that sometimes. I'm not going to do that today. So I just want you to think about other people, right? It's easier for us to be critical of other people. So just think about some people in your life that you know. And so we don't need to raise hands about ourselves, but we'll do this about some people you know. So because life is a battlefield, but we long for home, some of the ways that people react to that is becoming a hothead. These are people who decide, fine, if life is a battlefield, then I'm going to fight all the time, and I'm going to love conflict, and I see this conflict, and I'm going to stir it up, and I'm going to add more conflict to the conflict. Anybody know anybody like that? Anyone ever met anyone like that? Not saying that you are that, but anyone ever met anyone that is a hothead? That if there is no conflict in the moment, they will create it, and they will gravitate towards it. Other people try to adapt to the fact that life is a battlefield, but we long for home by becoming cynical. They become a cynic. Someone who is cynical, they're kind of living life with preemptive surrender. They have a negative attitude about things, a sarcastic attitude about things. They take the path of least resistance. Avoid taking responsibility for their lives, hoping that losing in the battle won't feel quite as painful if you just don't try. What's the point of trying? Life is this. Anybody ever met a cynic? Some people take on an attitude of defeat. Living angry, they recognize that life is a battle. And they just assume that they're never going to win. And they're angry about it. They're angry about the conflict. They're angry about for what it is. And so they live angry and resentful and frustrated and blaming and depressed. Anyone hypothetically ever knew of anybody like that? We don't always have to look at Jonathan for all of these, but you know. There's other people, and this is the one that is most common for us, is that we live in denial. So this hasn't been as accessible. Living in denial hasn't been as accessible of a coping mechanism for other times and other places as what it has been for us. We have better access to different drugs and to alcohol and to screens and entertainment. And we have air conditioning. We have disposable relationships that you can just swipe on somebody and put them in the cart and have them shipped to you somehow, I guess. I've never done it, but that's what people tell me. I think I understand. But all these copes, this living in denial, these buffers from reality, they're just denial. They're all fragile and they're all temporary and they're escapes from reality, and they end up leaving us even more anxious and weak because we are separating ourselves from reality. Because of that distance, and we know it. Cognitively or sometimes like subconsciously, we just know that we have become weak people because we're distanced from reality and we haven't faced it. Life is a battlefield, and I'm just going to pretend that it's not. But instead of being a hothead, a cynic, living with a defeated attitude or living in denial, David found another way. David accepted. He just accepted. And this is the first thing, the first step. He just accepted that life is a battlefield. It is. None of us are going to get out of this alive. Life will take everything away from you that you love and care about. He accepted that his life would never be safe, that his family would never be safe. But in accepting that, he found the path to strength. He found a path to actually moving on and finding something that is actual strength, that is actual solid ground, because everything else is going to wreck us. So if we are going to be strong, if we are going to be people that can be at peace, people that are full of joy no matter what the circumstances are, that we might be hurt and sad, but we are not broken, we are not destroyed, we have to accept that life is a battlefield. Look at, for people here that do Bibles, not all of you do for some reason, but people that do Bibles, look at verse 2 and 3, chapter 27, 2 and 3. David says, "When the wicked advance against me to devour me, it is my enemies and my foes who will stumble and fall. I am not concerned. Though an army besiege me, my heart will not fear." And that doesn't mean that David won every battle of his life. He absolutely didn't. "Though an army besiege me and my heart will not fear, though war break out against me, even then I will be confident." Look at verse 10. "Though my mother and my father forsake me," father and mother forsake me, "the Lord will receive me." Again, we are such individuals that we don't quite recognize all this is. But to be cast out from your people, to be, I love the Nordic, the ancient Nordic word for this, to be skagermond, to be outcast, is a fate often worse than death. So he's saying, even if the worst things happen, armies surround me, my own people desert me and abandon me, I will not be afraid. I will be confident. And then once we accept this first thing, two steps, once we accept this first, do this first step, accept this first thing that life is a battlefield, we're ready for the next one. David knew that God is our true home, our ultimate beauty, and our happy ending. Accept that life is a battlefield and know that God is our true home, our ultimate identity, and our happy ending. So look at verse 1. "The Lord is my light and my salvation." This means that God is my clarity and my strength, my safe place. "The Lord is the stronghold of my life, my safe place. In whom shall I be afraid?" God is. The Lord is. This person is. Verse 4, this one's pretty, really rich. "One thing," underline that if you're somebody that underlines, "one thing I ask for the Lord is that I, the Lord, this only do I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, that I may dwell in His presence and gaze on the beauty of the Lord and to seek Him in His temple. For in the day of trouble He will keep me safe in His dwelling. He will hide me in the shelter of His sacred tent and set me high on the rock." The presence, David is saying the presence of God is his home. That's where he lives. So the best example I could think of this, and I've used this before, but this is the closest tangible thing, is that wherever Carrie goes, that's my home. I didn't want to live here when we finished building this. I was so sick of it. I didn't want to like burn it down, but just like give it to somebody else. I'm so tired of this. And she's like, I'll make it where you want to live there. Wherever she goes, that's my home. And what does she do? She put some nice things out and decorated and started cooking and made a cup of coffee and things like that. And eventually the place feels like home. Places makes a place of a familiarity and comfort and well-being and those sorts of things. But I have a home that is deeper than that. That if I were to die, and I will die, or she was to die, and she will die, that we both have a home that is higher than that. That God is my true home, and God is her true home. And that's one of the things that I really love about her, and that we built our relationship on. That there's something that she loves more than me and something that I love more than her, and that's what we're all navigating by. And it doesn't make our relationship worse, it makes it. David saying that God is my home. Wherever God is in His presence, that is my home. So whether I'm standing on a battlefield smelling blood and excrement and sweat and adrenaline all around me, or I am beside a calm river, or I am at home in my bed, God is my true home. And that God is also our ultimate beauty. There's several different words for beauty in Hebrew, but this one is Noam. It means pleasure and perception. And beauty is so important. And one of the things that, if you want to destroy a people, destroy beauty. If you want to destroy a people, if you've ever seen Soviet bloc countries or pictures from that, they destroy beauty and remove beauty in order to dominate the people, because beauty calms and it heals and it inspires and it comforts and it brings you out of yourself. Generally, men and women bring beauty to the world in different ways. You know, people thought I was beautiful when I built this. They're like, oh, I could stand beside it and feel like what a girl feels like sometimes. Like, I will never actually be beautiful. And it's getting worse all the time. I'll never actually be beautiful, but I can do some things that are beautiful. So guys, like, that's your best bet. Like, do something impressive, you know, that people can look at and say, oh, look at my feathers, look at my feathers. Women do things that are beautiful and also are beautiful. And your beauty matters. All the ways that we bring beauty to the world, men and women, it matters. It calms, it heals, it inspires, it comforts, and it brings us out of ourselves. It brings healing to the world. If you want to resist evil in the world, there's two really great foundational ways to do that. You say what's true and you bring more beauty to the world. There's other things on top of that, but those are the top two. You say what's true and you bring more beauty to the world, and truth is beautiful on its own. But what David is saying is that the ultimate beauty of my life is God. God is the place that I find the most beautiful. He is the person that I find the most beautiful, where I find calm and healing and inspiration and comfort, and that brings me out of myself. Verse 5, that He will keep me safe in His dwelling place, in His presence. Verse 8 and 9. My heart says of you, seek His face. Your face, Lord, I will seek. Do not hide your face from me. Do not turn your servant away in anger. You have been my helper. Do not reject me or forsake me, God, my Savior. Face is a door, seeking your face. David mentions face three times there. It means it's not a philosophy that he's seeking. It's a person. A face is a doorway to a person. If you're talking to anyone and they're looking at your elbow, you're not really connecting in the same way that if you're looking at their face, right? If you want to connect with somebody, you look at their face. We could be having the same conversation, but all of our faces be turned away from each other, and we're missing something. So to seek somebody's face is a person, and it is to seek connection with them. It's a person. And then verse 10 and through 12, and also in 9. David is saying to God, you're the thing that I need. You're the thing that I need. If I have you, I have a happy ending. If I have you, I can lose everything else and be okay. And without you, I can have everything else and I'm not okay. Does that make sense? If I have you, I can lose I can lose everything else and be okay. If I have everything else and I don't have you, I'm not okay. I need you. David knew that God was his true home, his ultimate beauty, and his happy ending. So David's answer is very simple. In living in fearful circumstances, and dealing with all the anxieties and the fears of life. Somebody that could walk, could live his entire life under mortal threat of a horrible end for him and everyone that he loved, was to accept that life is a battlefield and know that God is your true home, your ultimate beauty, and your happy ending. And I hope this isn't missed on anyone, but this isn't just for David, right? That fearlessness and strength, confidence and courage are available to everyone who will make God their one thing, make God their delight, who will be captivated by God, not just find Him useful, not just find a Sunday teaching useful, but be captivated by Him as a person that you delight in. David broke the code on one of the most important things in life. And the question is always for us, what will we do with it? But more than breaking the code, David did something even more. And God's given us something even more. See, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as well, but Moses, David, these big prominent figures in the Old Testament, they were just signs and symbols of something to come. Shadows of what would be, promises looking forward, yet to be fulfilled. They were all pointing to something beyond themselves. See, David mentions, going into the temple. He could actually never go into the Holy of Holies that he longed for. Only the high priest could do that on behalf of all the people, and only one time a year, at Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Atonement's a word that means, it's kind of, is it an onomatopoeia? Something that sounds like it, at-one-ment. It's a word that is what it sounds like, but that might be more like bam or pow. Anyway, at-one-ment. The only time that somebody could actually come into the presence, the literal presence of God, was the high priest one time a year on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and only under certain circumstances. He prayed and he fasted with his people for days leading into this. He washed himself and washed himself and washed himself. Put on beautiful clean clothes. And then took in the blood of a sacrifice into the Holy of Holies. Put it on the Ark of the Covenant. Put it on the altar. And afterwards sent symbolically put all the sins of the people onto a goat and sent it off into the wilderness, cast off from the people as a scapegoat. That's where we get that from, a scapegoat. But Jesus, who the prophet John called the Lamb of God, who takes away the sin of the world, the one that Abraham saw as his seed, who would bless all the earth, who Moses foretold, Deuteronomy 18, that a true prophet and a lawgiver would come after him. Moses was amazing. And to say, hey y'all, I'm about to leave you, but I want you to know that there's going to be one that comes after me, and that's the one you follow. That's the one that you've been looking for. The one that King David declared was the long-awaited true King of Nations. Changed all of that for us. Changed that situation where David himself couldn't go into the Holy of Holies. Couldn't draw close to God. As the great high priest, Jesus made the ultimate atonement for us. On the day that he atoned for us, he was not washed clean and washed clean and washed clean, but he was filthy. He was spit upon. He was dirty. He was bloody. He was beaten beyond recognition. He didn't have beautiful clothes to wear, but was naked. And he didn't approach the altar with the blood of bulls, but with his own blood. And he didn't cast the goat symbolically out of the camp so that we could be forgiven. But he cast his own self out of the camp so that we could find peace with God. And there's no greater beauty than that. David had this to look forward to into the future through a veil, through a shadow, through interpreted words of promise. But we know what that is, that ultimate beauty, because ultimate beauty is sacrificial love. There's no greater beauty than that. And it's an answer for all of our fears and all of our anxieties. It's the answer for how we find joy and strength and clarity and calm in the battlefield of life. Even better than what David had. So if we fix our eyes on the beautiful sacrifice of God and be captivated by that, and let that become our one thing, this king that died for us, let him be our true home. Let him be our happy ending. And when we do, if we meditate on that, if we take that into our souls, then no threats and no losses and no griefs and no pains will be able to destroy us. Yes, we'll be hurt. With greater love comes greater pain. And when you walk towards Jesus, when you fix your eyes on him, your capacity for love grows. But nothing will destroy you. Not even defeat will defeat you, because of the love of God that is in Christ Jesus has become this foundation for your soul. That is the answer to all of life's fears and all of life's anxieties. Fix your eyes on Him. Let Him become your ultimate home, your ultimate beauty, and your happy ending. May you say yes to the gift that God is holding out to you today. Amen.